There we go. Welcome, everyone, to Savitri on Infinite Conversations, Sri Aurobindo Savitri, the Dionysian Cup of Bliss. We're resuming in Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 7, The Descent into Night, on page 211. And in this, Ashwapati is going through the obverse and reverse life worlds, coming like looking for the cause and failure of the higher worlds of life, and he's needing to descend in order to see that clearly and to find keys for the transformation. And there's a lot in this canto that's I would say instruction on coping with falsehood and ignorance, instruction on coping with darkness and a power that is structured on force and falsehood. A lot of this is seems to me really relevant to what's going on today in the world. But does anyone else have anything to add to that before we jump right in? And one more thing. And so we've dipped from the life worlds into the descent into the night, and we eventually will emerge into the worlds of mind. So as far as the narrative arc in the book of the Traveler of the World, he's going through these different worlds, these different parts of our being, these different planes of consciousness and parts of our being also. I think it's I sense it's both, and so we will emerge after this, after the next two cantos, into the I'm scrolling through into the kingdoms and godheads of the little mind and emerging from there. So yeah, does anyone else have anything that they want to add? Great. Let's meditate for a few minutes, 3 to 5 minutes. Andrea, can you time that? And then we'll go Marco, John Robert, Andrea, and Jeffrey, and Matteo. Welcome, Jeffrey. Can you hear us? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. My car is in trouble, but I'm not going to do anything about it until I have my meeting with the doctor, and then I'll deal with it. So.
Okay. We just finished a meditation. We're going to go Marco, John Robert, Andrea, Jeffrey, Mateo.
All right, I'll get started.
Marco, could you just read a page and a half?
Sure. So this is book two, canto seven, starting the section in the middle of page 211. And let me just fix my, I'm not going to fix that. A greater darkness waited, a worse rain. If worse can be where all is evil's extreme. Yet to the cloaked, the uncloaked is naked worst. There God and truth and the supernal light had never been or else had power no more. As when one slips in a deep moment's trance, over mind's border into another world, he crossed a boundary whose stealthy trace I could not see, but only the soul feel. Into an armored, fierce domain he came, and saw himself wandering like a lost soul amid grimed walls and savage slums of night. Around him crowded gray and squalid huts, neighboring proud palaces of perverted power, inhuman quarters and demonic wards, a pride in evil hugged its wretchedness. A misery haunting splendor pressed those fell dun suburbs of the cities of dream life. There life displayed to the spectator soul the shadow depths of her strange miracle. A strong and fallen goddess without hope, obscured, deformed by some dire gorgon spell, as might a harlot empress in a bouge, nude, unashamed, exulting, she upraised her evil face of perilous beauty and charm, and, drawing panic to a shuddering kiss twixt the magnificence of her fatal breasts, allured to their abyss, the spirits fall. Across his field of sight she multiplied, as on a scenic film or moving plate, the implacable splendor of her nightmare pomps. On the dark background of a soulless world, she staged between a lurid light and shade her dramas of the sorrow of the depths, written on the agonized nerves of living things. Epics of horror and grim majesty, wry statues spat and stiffened in life's mud. A glut of hideous forms and hideous deeds, paralyzed pity in the hardened breast. In booths of sin and night repairs of vice, styled infamies of the body's concupiscence and sordid imaginations etched in flesh, turned lust into a decorative art, abusing nature's gift. Her pervert skill immortalized the sown grain of living death. In a mud goblet poured the Bacchic wine. To a satyr gave the thyrsus of a god, impure, sadistic, with grimacing mouths, gray, foul inventions, gruesome and macabre, came televisioned from the gulfs of night. Her craft ingenious in monstrosity, impatient of all natural shape and poise, a gape of nude exaggerated lines, gave caricature a stark reality, and art parades of weird distorted forms, and gargoyle masks obscene and terrible, trampled to tormented postures on the torn sense.
An inexorable evil's worshiper, she made vileness great and sublimated filth. A dragon power of reptile energies and strange epiphanies of groveling force and serpent grandeurs crouching in the mire drew adoration to a gleam of slime. All nature pulled out of her frame and base was twisted into an unnatural pose. Repulsion stimulated inert desire. Agony was made a red spiced food for bliss. Hatred was trusted with the work of lust, and torture took the form of an embrace. A ritual anguish consecrated death. Worship was offered to the undivine. A new aesthesis of Inferno's art that trained the mind to love what the soul hates, imposed allegiance on the quivering nerves, and forced the unwilling body to vibrate. Too sweet and too harmonious to excite in this regime that soiled the being's core, beauty was banned. The heart's feeling dulled to sleep and cherished in their place sensation's thrills. The world was probed for jets of sense appeal. Here, cold material intellect was the judge and needed sensual prick and jog and lash that its hard dryness and dead nerves might feel some passion and power and acrid point of life. A new philosophy theorized evil's rights, gloried in the shimmering rod of decadence, or gave to a python force persuasive speech, and armed with knowledge, the primeval brute.
Over life and matter, only brooding bowed, mind changed to the image of a rampant beast. It scrambled into the pit to dig for truth, and lighted its surge with the subconscious flares. Thence bubbling rose, sullying the upper air, the filth and festering secrets of the abyss. This is called positive fact and real life. This now composed the fetid atmosphere. A wild beast passion crept from secret night to watch its prey with fascinating eyes. Around him, like a fire with sputtering tongues, there lolled and laughed a bestial ecstasy. The air was packed with longings brute and fierce, crowding and stinging in a monstrous swarm, pressed with a noxious hum into his mind, thoughts that could poison nature's heavenliest breath. Forcing reluctant lids assailed the sight, acts that revealed the mystery of hell. All that was there was on this pattern made.
Does anyone know what theursis means? To a satyr gave...
It's a staff.
I'm sorry, staff. Thank
you. It's a staff of the devotees of Bacchus.
Does anyone know what bouge means? As might a harlot empress in a bouge?
It's a brothel.
Brothel. Oh. How about Gorgon? Dire Gorgon spell?
Female figure who could turn men to stone with their eyes.
Ooh. How is that different than Medusa? Didn't she do that?
Yeah, I think the Gorgon and the Medusa is the same beast.
They were sisters. The sisters. Medusa was one of the sisters.
Oh, cool.
Oh, joy.
It's like a scene from Hieronymus Bosch is kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Garden of Earthly Delights and the, yeah, there's some, yeah, I see what you mean.
It's like sensuous, but in the other way, you know? It feels very sensuous in a way, but it's the other direction.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah. Her description, where is that? Oh my God.
Because it's forceful, it's separativity of consciousness fighting itself out. It's, like sadomasochistic, it needs pain to feel pleasure.
I think that there's an interesting psychological analysis here as well, because he's pointing to what Gene Gebser would call, I believe, like the deficient mental. Like there's a mentality here.
I'm sorry, Marco, the what mental?
The deficient mental. So Gebser had this idea that, and this is more for the benefit of, you know, other listeners, that consciousness over history went through certain mutations, and it's like deep structure or deep patterning. And in known human history, it's gone through four or five of those, from the archaic kind of primordial state to what you call the magic, mythic, mental, and then this emergent integral structure that he sees, arising. And the mental and all of the structures go, like they have different modes as it were, one of which could be what he calls efficient, when it's sort of doing it's what it's supposed to do and it's in its healthy expression, and it's, you know, serving to disclose a world that is sort of in its ascendancy or in its prime. And then it can also be deficient, where it begins sliding into, I guess, what like somebody like Nietzsche would call decadence, and it loses its sort of effective power and begins like relying on other factors to continue to survive. In this case, when you have a deficient mentality and it can no longer feel the life force because it's abstracted away from the body, from Earth, from like the sources of vital energy, then it needs extra stimulation in order to feel alive and to feel meaningful and purposeful and to he doesn't say this here, but I think that part of what's happening too is like to ward off that feeling of nihilism or nothingness or meaninglessness or emptiness, like to ward off just the plain stark reality of the emptiness of the realm of the phenomena that one is experiencing. In this case, it's their pleasures, there's stimulation, there's excitement. It's like going to Las Vegas, you know, there's lights and thrills to be had. But at the end of the day, you end up kind of depleted by them. They don't like nurture more life. They kind of feed off of life energy. And, And so this kind of sort of inverted or twisted like hedonism like arises. And I feel like that's what he's describing here, is this sort of aesthetic hedonism, which is partly the result of the, and I, there are some specific lines here, which I haven't refound, but it's sort of the desensitizing of abstract, detached, separative mentality that brings us to seek out these kinds of pleasures. I think that that's what he's saying here. It's the new aesthesis of Inferno's art, he calls it, that trained the mind to love what the soul hates. And then this kind of interesting lines, imposed allegiance on the quivering nerves and forced the unwilling body to vibrate. It's like this almost being, you know, it's like it's coercive, or it's non-consensual in a way, like in, you know, today's language, it's kind of like being manipulated to
violated,
yes.
Violated.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're being told it's for your own good.
Beauty was banned and the heart's feelings dulled to sleep, and cherished in their place sensation's thrills. The world was probed for jets of sense appeal. And then here, cold material intellect was the judge, and needed sensual prick and jog and lash, that its hard dryness and dead nerves might feel some passion and power, an acrid point of life. And then a new philosophy theorized evil's rights. I mean, is he talking about like the Marquis de Sade or something? Like, who does he have in mind here? I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
The GOP.
Right. Yeah, this is kind of post-truth relativism, maybe, and just pure kind of, you know, might is right. I won't comment on that.
I was thinking GOP de Sade.
I see a bumper sticker out of that. That'd make a nice t-shirt or something.
Shall I continue? A race possessed inhabited those parts. A force demoniac lurking in man's depths that heaves suppressed by the heart's human law, awed by the calm and sovereign eyes of thought, can in a fire and earthquake of the soul arise, and calling to its native night, overthrow the reason, occupy the life, and stamp its hoof on nature's shaking ground. This was for them their being's flaming core. A mighty energy, a monster god, hard to the strong, implacable to the weak, it stared at the harsh and pitying world it made with the stony eyelids of its fixed idea. Its heart was drunk with a dire hunger's wine. In others' suffering felt a thrilled delight, and of death and ruin the grandiose music heard. To have power, to be master, was soul virtue and good. It claimed the whole world for evil's living room. Its party's grim totalitarian reign, the cruel destiny of breathing things.
All in one plan was shaped and standardized under a dark dictatorship's breathless weight. In street and house, in councils and in courts, beings he met who looked like living men and climbed in speech upon high wings of thought, but harbored all that is subhuman, vile, and lower than the lowest reptiles crawl. The reason meant for nearness to the gods and uplift to heavenly scale by the touch of mind, only enhanced by its enlightening ray, their inborn nature's wry monstrosity. Often, a familiar visage, studying joyfully, encountered at some dangerous turn, hoping to recognize a look of light, his vision warned by the spirit's inward eye, discovered suddenly hell's trademark there, and or saw with the inner sense that cannot err, in the semblance of a fair or virile form, the demon and the goblin and the ghoul. An insolence reigned of cold, stone-hearted strength, mighty, obeyed, approved by the Titan's law, the huge laughter of a giant cruelty, and fierce, glad deeds of ogre violence. In that wide, cynic den of thinking beasts, one looked in vain for the trace of pity or love. There was no touch of sweetness anywhere, but only force and its acolytes, greed and hate. There was no help for suffering, none to save. None dared resist or speak a noble word. Armed with the aegis of tyrannic power, signing the edicts of her dreadful rule, and using blood and torture as a seal, darkness proclaimed her slogans to the world.
A servile, blinkered silence hushed the mind, or only it repeated lessons taught, while mitred, holding the good shepherd's staff, falsehood enthroned on awed and prostrate hearts, the cults and creeds that organize living death and slay the soul on the altar of a lie. All were deceived or served their own deceit. Truth, in that stifling atmosphere, could not live. There, wretchedness believed in its own joy, and fear and weakness hugged their abject depths. All that is low and sordid, thoughted, base. All that is drab and poor and miserable breathed in a lax content its natural air and felt no yearning of divine release. Arrogant, jibing at more luminous states, the people of the gulfs despised the sun. A barriered autarchy excluded light, fixed in its will to be its own gray self. It vaunted its norm, unique and splendid type. It smoothed its hunger with a plunderer's dream, flaunting its cross of servitude like a crown. It clung to its dismal, harsh autonomy. A bull throat bellowed with its brazen tongue, its hard and shameless clamor filling space and threatening all who dared to listen to truth, claimed the monopoly of the battered ear. A deafened acquiescence gave its vote, and braggart dogmas shouted in the night, kept for the fallen soul, once deemed a god, the pride of its abysmal absolute.
sure like looks like we are witnessing that happening in our country these days. Truth doesn't have a foot to stand on.
Earlier, Marco asked what we thought Aurobindo was thinking about when he was writing this, and this passage to me just seems like he's talking about the Nazis.
It's hard not to feel like he's talking about the present day at the same time.
Yeah, it's in the same boat, you know, those two. And what's happening now, it's in the same consciousness.
Well, it kind of was his present day at one point, right? So almost.
Yeah, yeah.
On a more personal note, I think it's kind of funny that as we're sitting down to read this passage, my car decides to give up the ghost, and I sort of feel like the tentacles have gotten into my technology.
And at the same time, yes, Jeffrey, I feel that sometimes too, that's like the interconnected web and everything touching everything. At the same time, so what's going on today is also a spur for humanity to understand how to process all of this stuff. I'm just seeing more and more savvy tools for taking like whole news articles and plugging it into these algorithms that can crank, that have massive data banks of news sources to be able to determine how well articles have been fact checked, to be able to determine the political slant of the reporting. There's just all sorts of tools that are coming available. And yesterday I was talking with Jeffrey. I'm so excited about the 2020 Massey lectures coming up. I can't remember the name of the lecturer, but the book and the lecture is called Reset. And the subtitle is something like retaking the fabric back of social media. And I couldn't help but think that the author is talking about things like infinite conversations. And we're by far not the only group that's using technology to connect in a deep and meaningful way. But the author, and I haven't read this book or listened to the lectures, they're not out until late October or early November or something like that. But it's also a real savvy way of critiquing social media and examining where we're at with our early interface in the age of technology. This is only an early form that we have here. And it seems to me like the powers there's so many more powers utilizing the GOP decade, right? This postmodern, disgusting mess of placing ignorance and falsehood equal to truth, with the claim that all truths are equal, and then the manipulative plays around that. I see larger groups getting more savvy. Actually, it's just like I don't know. It's like it's different than Nazi. What's going on here seems close. Yeah, I see the Nazi Germany in here. I see Hitler in here. And I also see today in here, like there's a really, he had this like vast way of looking ahead through all of this. And to me, this, of course, I didn't live through Nazi Germany and all of that. And it's just a couple of generations removed. But this just seems so much closer to what's going on today, maybe because it's ever present for us.
Well, it probably is the same night of consciousness that is rearing its head again, you know, because we need to become fully conscious of it, of that potential in ourselves and in our collective. And yeah, we would have hoped that with World War II, it was all over and would never happen again. And now the beauty is actually that it is more visible, and that there is not a reign of fear like there was then. They were able to, you know, just kill at random and have people be terrified as a nation, and that we can't have. I mean, so far.
Yeah, people are fighting back in the most fierce way that we've seen, and fighting the falsehood and misinformation, disinformation.
Yeah, we've kind of demonized, we've certainly demonized the Nazis and Hitler. It's like most people think that Hitler wasn't even human, but of course he was. You know, he wasn't that different in some ways than we are. And people think that is absurd. You know, they can't even get their heads around that idea. So I've long felt that Trump, although, you know, I'm not a fan, and obviously what we're going through is difficult and has had major impacts on people's lives, right? But I've long felt that these kinds of politicians express something that needs to come out in the popular sphere in order to work itself through. You have to bring these things to the surface so that they can be worked through. So I kind of think that there's a side to all of this which is actually more encouraging than discouraging. It's allowing people to work through stuff that otherwise would sit and used to sit around unspoken of, but it was there. And now it's on the surface where one can see it and see, well, maybe this isn't the right way to do things, at least for most people. So.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Jeffrey.
Yeah, me too.
Trump himself said something that was really interesting. After Michelle Obama's speech at the Democratic Convention a couple of weeks ago, she was talking about her husband and, you know, as kind of an ideal president. And Trump said, because of him, I'm here. And I thought, that's pretty savvy. Because there was a lot of, like you guys were saying, there was a lot of this stuff going on, but it wasn't acknowledged during earlier administrations. And so there is a certain continuity between the past politics and the present politics. And we get to see it all now.
I'll never forget Obama's inauguration address, where he basically told all the people that got him to power, go home now and go to sleep. I mean, this has been heavily commented on, but that might be kind of what happened. And now with the dragon whipping his tail, no one's going to go to sleep, not with all that stuff on the surface. And the guns present and the vehicles running over people, all these things, like, humans can't abide with this. It's like, it's very different than people compare this to Nazism in Germany. There might be like similarity in the occult, similarity in the unseen, in the unseen regions of this, but it just feels so different to me. It doesn't, I don't know. Did you say that the fear is different? The same fear isn't there. It's like, I don't think we're capable of rounding up 6 million people and putting them in gas chambers. And I sense that we're past that, but again, maybe I'm naive. I don't know.
There are more massacres in the late 20th century than almost any time in history, aside from the World War II.
Right, we look at the DRC and Rwanda. Yeah, thank you, exactly. Jeffrey, you're right, yeah.
They're huge.
Yeah.
They're not over it, you know?
Yeah, good point.
It's also that, you can take methods, you know, like Nazi methods, and scale them and use information technology to kind of maximize your, you know, your ability to control or to, you know, even exterminate like people. I think this is part of what China is trying to do with the Uyghur population. There's a lot written on that. And, you know, how they're using the combination of face detection, deep learning, basically, you know, AI types of technologies to really create just kind of a massive net across the whole society where everything is being surveilled, everybody is being tracked. And, you know, anyone who deviates from the party line, from the kind of, the kind of society that China is trying to create, which is, this is a bigger conversation, but it's sort of like authoritarian capitalism, something like this very interesting, weird hybrid mashup of strong central, you know, rulership by decree and like liberating kind of the economic, you know, the spirit of people to consume and enjoy and produce, and then supercharging that with you know, AI kind of technology. I mean, in a way, like you can see utopias coming out of it, and you could also see dystopias far worse than Nazi Germany. And I think partly it depends on how some of these occult kinds of energies and patterns play themselves out. Because, I mean, in a way, you can see that like Trumpism, which is, you know, he's not unique in a certain way. He's kind of like Silvio Berlusconi on steroids or something. Like he's sort of like an American version of a archetypal political character that you can find going back to, you know, ancient Greece. And, you know, Plato was writing about tyrants, and there was already thought being given to like, how does it happen that, you know, the popular will in a democratic society can elect for its own destruction in a way, like for its own debasement. So it's very deep dynamics. And what I think is, I think we are more sophisticated than we were in the beginning of the 20th century, because we've been through World War II. We've been through, you know, all of the wars of decolonization and all of the social struggles, and, you know, we're so much more transparent. We can see so much more in real time what's happening all over the world. So I totally agree with you, Matteo, that so many people are fighting back, and they're really struggling against the falsehood, and they're struggling to keep alive a different vision, like keep alive that higher evolutionary possibility, which I think is spurred by that, because Obama couldn't have come. And I remember how inspirational that was. I participated in that. Like I did my part, you know, to bring that about. And I was disappointed as well with the sort of attitude or the tone that came. Everybody did pack up and go home, and they set up some super PACs or something like that to, you know, to manage the money and the email lists. But you lost, like, there was not a sense that we were engaged as a democratic citizenry, you know, in the rebuilding our nation, which had already been, you know, really traumatized by 9/11, the Iraq War, and, you know, that's almost like just, you know, long lost memories. But this is like really, you know, crucial events that have happened in the recent past. We couldn't have had Obama without G.W. Bush,
yeah,
and Cheney and that gang. They were sort of the original dark, you know, the dark forces inside of the administrations. Not the originals, obviously. They were kind of a new iteration, and now it seems just to have blown the lid off of it. Really, like there's not even pretending to be, any kind of decorum or any kind of, you know, concern for the whole. So. Yeah.
There's a couple of interesting books. One of them is called Democracy in Chains, which is about James Buchanan, who was the, he was an economist. I think he died in 2013 or something like that. And he was the mastermind of the latest version of neoliberalism, starting with the Reagan administration, and has its branches everywhere in ALEC and some of these other organizations. And he was very secretive. Even though he was a Nobel laureate, he was very secretive about his political and economic philosophy. But he was the mastermind and the inspiration of all these different think tanks and organizations, and eventually hooked up with the Koch brothers, who had the money to put his ideas into practice. And the other book, which is really interesting, and I can't remember the name of it, it came out of Oroville just about a year ago, by I think Richard Chamberlain, I think that's his name, I'm not sure. So I don't have the name of the book I can get it because I read it recently. And it's about all of these different forces that we're talking about, especially the technological forces like AI. But using AI, which is a human created power, to change the balance of power for consciousness and evolutionary development. It's a science fiction book. It's not very far into the future, though. It's just basically talking about AI and the battle between some forces of consciousness and all of these other forces of financial capitalism and oligarchy.
If you can find the title of that book, I'd love to look into it.
Yeah, I can find it momentarily, in fact, I think. Let's see here.
Was James Buchanan Reagan's Secretary of State, or what position?
No, he didn't have any. He became the head of a new economic department at the University of Chicago.
Oh, he
that
was
has been the training
Milton Friedman.
He was trained at Chicago, but he was the kind of the dark side of Milton Friedman.
Oh.
Okay, let me see here. It's called Radical Network, and it's by Paul Blanchflower. Radical is spelled RADICLE. So it's, you know, it's about roots, and it's actually about trees and AI and consciousness. It's a really interesting book. It's a page turner. You know, it's fun to read, and yet it has all these kind of profound implications. And it's on Amazon, so I read it on Kindle, well, a Kindle app.
What's the second word of the title?
Radical Network. Paul Blanchflower. I wasn't close to the right author's name, but that is the right one.
I mean, what I wanted to say, though, I think I didn't complete a point that I make. So this is why I think we can't be just jump ahead in the story, because something coming through the system, like it could be just a complex, a kind of knot, something that can, once it's released, leave the body and let it heal. But it can be like a cancer. It could be something that actually like takes over and destroys the organism. And I mean, that's what I think is the danger in going into the night realms and into these, you know, these pattern spaces, which I think it's interesting that he describes this as a pattern. It's something that recurs, you know, and it recurs in different expressions, different scales maybe, but the thing is there. And it's like, if the pattern gets out of control, if the pattern becomes kind of metastatic, then. I think that's really where, you know, the future evolution in this particular line, you know, this particular, of our particular humanity maybe isn't assured. But then again, if we can recognize the pattern and we can mitigate it and we can, you know, move ourselves and, you know, through network effects, perhaps like this fellow's talking about in the book, John Robert, you know, we can counter, I think we can counteract those patterns with health, better patterns, with healthier patterns. That's what I think part of what this book is doing, what it seems to be doing, is showing us really clearly how all these patterns in consciousness work, and then how we could sort of move through them and move into, you know, the more expansive, the more harmonious patterns. I think this is just, we can go on and on about this, but we're not here to just jab, just share. We're here to read.
I think it's okay, Marco. Yes, but I think it's okay. There's a lot going on right now that it seems to me really healthy to have dialogue and conversation like this.
I thought this science fiction book that I just mentioned was really interesting, because I think AI is one of the patterns that can really get out of control, especially when it's produced without examining the kind of the axioms and the suppositions that go into it. AI is designed just to kind of continue on its own. It learns, it creates creates solutions for a certain kind of problem, and then just keeps building and building and building on that because it's self-learning. And in this book, they use that property of AI for a different kind of outcome. So there's some consciousness of what the suppositions are that they're using it from. And I think a lot of times in our culture, we have the idea that if it can be done, let's do it without investigating whether it's a good idea to do it or not, because it gives power, because it gives, you know, or and exciting. And one other thing I wanted to say in response to Marco was that in the next canto, which is also about the dark, I think Sri Aurobindo gives he says what Ashwapati does to get through this, because Ashwapati in the next canto is going to go deeper into this dark. He says precisely what he does to survive it.
Marco, do you want to go ahead and pick up at that break?
Sure. A lone discoverer in these menacing realms, guarded like termite cities from the sun, oppressed mid crowd and tramp and noise and flare, passing from dusk to deeper, dangerous dusk. He wrestled with powers that snatched from mind its light and smote from him their clinging influences. Soon he emerged in a dim, wall-less space. For now the peopled tracts were left behind. He walked between wide banks of failing eve. Around him grew a gaunt spiritual blank, a threatening waste, a sinister loneliness that left mind bare to an unseen assault, an empty page on which all that willed could write stark, monstrous messages without control. A traveling dot on downward roads of dusk, mid barren fields and barns and straggling huts and a few crooked and phantasmal trees. He faced a sense of death and conscious void. But still a hostile life unseen was there, whose death-like poise resisting light and truth made living a bleak gap in nullity. He heard the grisly voices that deny, assailed by thoughts that swarmed like spectral hordes, a prey to the staring phantoms of the gloom and terror approaching with its lethal mouth, driven by a strange will down, ever down, the sky above, a communique of doom. He strove to shield his spirit from despair, but felt the horror of the growing night and the abyss rising to claim his soul. Then ceased the abodes of creatures and their forms, and solitude wrapped him in its voiceless folds. All vanished suddenly, like a thought expunged. His spirit became an empty listening gulf, void of the dead illusion of a world. Nothing was left, not even an evil face. He was alone with the gray python night. A dense and nameless nothing, conscious, mute, which seemed alive but without body or mind, lusted all beings to annihilate that it might be forever nude and soul.
As in a shapeless beast's intangible jaws, gripped, strangled by that lusting, viscous blot, attracted to some black and giant mouth and swallowing throat and a huge belly of doom, his being from its own vision disappeared, drawn toward depths that hungered for its fall. A formless void oppressed his struggling brain. A darkness, grim and cold, benumbed his flesh. A whispered gray suggestion chilled his heart. Hailed by a serpent force from its warm home and dragged to extinction in bleak vacancy, life clung to its seat with cords of gasping breath. Lapped was his body by a tenebrous tongue. Existence smothered, travailed to survive. Hope strangled, perished in his empty soul. Belief and memory abolished, died, and all that helps the spirit in its course. There crawled through every tense and aching nerve, leaving behind its poignant quaking trail, a nameless and unutterable fear. As a sea nears a victim bound and still, the approach alarmed his mind, forever dumb, of an implacable eternity of pain inhuman and intolerable. This he must bear, his hope of heaven estranged. He must ever exist without extinction's peace in a slow suffering time and tortured space, an anguished nothingness, his endless state. A lifeless vacancy was now his breast. And in the place where once was luminous thought, only remained like a pale, motionless ghost, an incapacity for faith and hope and the dread conviction of a vanquished soul, immortal still, but with its Godhead lost, self lost and God and touch of happier worlds. but he endured. Stilled the vain terror, bore the smothering coils of agony and affright. Then peace returned and the soul's sovereign gaze. To the blank horror, a calm light replied. Immutable, undying and unborn, mighty and mute, the Godhead in him woke and faced the pain and danger of the world. He mastered the tides of nature with a look. He met with his bare spirit, naked hell. End of Canto 7.
Wow, after all that, this moment there, he mastered the tides of nature with a look. I think I really feel underneath all that is going on in our world a nameless and unutterable fear. It's in the middle of that previous page that I don't tend to acknowledge, but it's in here.
I keep having the thought with 2020 in general that the mantra of the times right now is I don't know, right? And that not knowing coming forward is scary for a lot of people. That I think that there's a lot of fear in not knowing. A lot of it's scary to not understand who we are, where we are, why we are. All these really deep questions. That I think give us a purpose in life, give us a raison d'etre, and it's all this stuff seems like it's coming forward. But I don't know. It seems really beautiful to me, and I kind of hem and haw about saying it that way because it looks really awful. It's not like it's beautiful in a way where I'm I don't feel like I'm reveling in the disgustingness. There's a fight. There's a dog fight going on too. Things are heavy right now. I was talking with Jeffrey yesterday about sharing with Jeffrey yesterday that I love the CBC show that I feel like no one's heard of but Jeffrey, and it made me so happy that he's heard of it. It's called Ideas, and it's on CBC Canadian Broadcasting Radio. It's hosted by Nala Ayed, and they look at a lot of things really deeply, and they're having a look at Milton's Paradise Lost. They're doing a multiple part series on it, and it's really beautiful. There's stories about this man in Syrian jail translating it into Syrian for the first time on toilet paper. Like the stories about him doing this are actually phenomenal. But in looking at this, I feel like they're trying to take something that was written 300 or 400 years ago and they're trying to find depth and significance of what's going on today. And I can't help but listen to something like that and be like, oh man, I wish that they knew what savitri was. Because to me, the tool, I've only had a superficial glance at Paradise Lost. I've read it, I've had two passes through it. I've done a tiny bit of studying on it, but nothing near what I'm doing with savitri, because savitri to me is just packed with tools for conviviality, tools for working our way through this. And I can't help but wish that more and more people knew what we had here and knew what we're working with here. Maybe I'll call Nala Ayed. our dear Jonathan Kay actually has met her through through the Toronto connection and his music connections.
But of course, Marco and John and I and others read Paradise Lost lately because of Savitri. I mean, we got into it because we were looking at other connections with Savitri. So I have to go, folks, for my, and my car is working now, so I'm kind of pleased that seemed to work itself out. I don't know whether I have to turn it off and then we'll see whether it turns back on when I come back out. But
Perhaps you mastered the tides of nature with a look.
So this was wonderful. Even if I was off and on again, it was lovely to be with you and read this.
Take care, Jeff.
Good to see you.
Are we going to read it again all the way through next time, or are you going to read that through now?
I think next time sounds good to me. We can have a pass through it and then emerge into the next canto, if that sounds good to everyone. We can have a chat and then a meditation and wrap up.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Bye, Jeffrey.
And I don't, that was a suggestion. I wasn't saying that that was the way that it had to be.
That sounds good to me. I love the way this canto ends.
Thank God.
But I, to me, it also ties to what like what you were just saying, Matteo, about the theme of this year. Like, I don't know. I think there's another theme connected. It's like, I don't know, but also look. Like, to me, this is like a year of revelation. It's a year of seeing like everything being unveiled, you know, the cover torn off, the scab torn off the wound, you know, the veil, you know, removed from the, you know, we're seeing the sham for what it is, like to the extent that a lot of our material culture and, you know, the ways that we choose to entertain ourselves and feed ourselves and, you know, keep an economy growing at 2 or 3 or however, whatever percent we want, like we're seeing through all that. But we have to look. And like what I think, you know, when something becomes so loud and so apparent and so blatant and so shameless, like Trumpism, then it just forces you to look. Like you can't sweep it under the rug. You can't go, you know, continue to go about your, you know, your conventional, you know, life. Like it forces you to alter your ways, but it comes, I think, part of the pattern that as a society we tend to be in is avoidance and escape and evasion, looking away, you know, trying to, you know, bury ourselves in whatever, binge watching TV or, you know, Facebook or whatever. There was one point here when he talked about the empty page on which all that willed could write stark monstrous messages without control. I was like, is that not like the definition of social media? And but what is it that gets us through this? It's like the God in him woke and mastered the tides of nature with a look. He met with his bare spirit, naked hell. And I mean, the way that I interpret that at this point is like, we can't look away. Like we have to look at what's actually happening and see it for what it is. And that's the way through it and beyond it. But until we do, it just will keep on rearing its ugly head. And you know, it wants to be acknowledged. It wants to be integrated. And to the extent that we don't or refuse to, it grows in power. It grows stronger, you know, until we can't help but deal with it.
I really like what you said. I always feel that what has happened with Trump coming into power, that he's the perfect instrument. I couldn't have been a better instrument to expose and make visible the shadow of the American ego. It's absolutely perfect. I am the greatest. That is the very falsehood that is in the American ego. And it's out for display for the whole world to see, you know? We can't deny it anymore. That's the beauty of it. I'm also reminded, I'd like to mention this, there is a, about this not looking away, there is a movie that's called Don't Look Away. I believe that's the title of it. It's in the aftermath of World War II. It's just it's a work of art. And it's about the extermination during Nazi times of the mentally ill. And the brother who witnesses his sister, and as his sister is carried away, she says to him when he's still a young boy, don't look away. Yeah, it's a very worthwhile film to see. It's a work of art, really.
Tying in what Marco said with what you just said, Andrea, I suppose we've all been reading, I'm sorry, except for Marco, we've all been reading Savitri with a lot of people for a long time. And one thing I've seen, not with everyone, but I have seen looking away with these two cantos that we're involved in right now, Descent into Night and the World of Falsehood, Mother of Evil, Sons of Darkness. And then I went to Germany for my first time in 2015, 2016, I can't remember, went to the AVI Germany conference, and I love asking people, what's your favorite canto in Savitri, half joking, because I couldn't answer that question myself, what's your favorite canto? It's kind of a trickster question, but a number of Germans separately answered these two cantos, and I'm like, holy shit, in America, I see a shrinking away from these cantos, not just in general, it's something that I've felt over the years, people don't want to linger within this space of these two cantos. And I said, I asked them, but it was really two different people separately that said that, and I said, why? And he said, because we can't look away from falsehood, because we actually have to be able to look at this stuff to be able to pass through it. And I was really affected by that. It seemed really beautiful and profound to me.
Yeah, that is the gift of post-World War II Germany. They are actively doing that as a society. It's awesome. Yeah.
I was reading some of Joanna Macy yesterday. And her husband died not so long ago. And in order to deal with his death, they were married for something like 54 years. And she said it was like falling in love over and over again with him. So she went into Rilke's work and she started translating Rilke's work and writing about it. And a lot about his poetry on death. And again, the message was the same thing. It was being present both to the terror and the wonder of life, both to being present, not looking away, not running away, but being there.
Years ago, I listened to former UN High Commissioner of refugees, Jan Egeland. I think he's Norwegian, but I'll never forget in this interview where he said that the one thing that's different about today is there's eyes on everything. There's potentially eyes on everything. And he's like, at the very least, we can sit at the table with the despots and say, we're watching you. Like the UN at that, this was 10 years ago or maybe even 15 years ago that I heard Jan Egeland say this, but it seems so profound to me because it's like, yeah, the UN doesn't really have the power yet to stop the greatest atrocities. Maybe we're getting close, but the U.S. doesn't really have the power yet to stop it. We're using our global military for typically to secure resources, cheaper resources for our own population, etc. But it just seems so deep to me that Jan Egglin was like, at least I'll sit at the table with war criminals and people who have committed crimes against humanity. And at least I can say, we know your name and we're watching you. And that just, it seems so beautiful. And it was different, right? All of this stuff was hidden 50, 60 years ago, right? East Timor, there maybe were some intellectuals that knew that it was happening, but it wasn't a mass thing. Pol Pot and killing a quarter of the population in Cambodia, 76 to 79. It wasn't really, I wasn't even in kindergarten, but the sense that I get was not that many people even knew that it was happening who weren't directly touched by things like that. And now times are just different. George Floyd, that name is global at this point. Everyone knows George Floyd's name. And people are watching Lukashenko now, whereas before, yeah, people find out about these things. The global village, Marshall McLuhan's coined term global village has really come into being now. Yeah, it's an exciting time to be alive, really. Not easy, but it's exciting. Nice to be back with you.
Yeah, I feel like we can go on further down this road. I totally agree with everything you're saying, like that, everybody's got a video camera right on their person, you know, and atrocities, crimes, mistreatment, and even just, bad ethics, like, it's sort of the age of the whistleblower in a way. And all this comes out, I think that's necessary and wonderful and exciting. It also presents a whole nother set of challenges, because when so much is hitting you, like there's such a barrage of injustice, such a barrage of horror, horror of it requires more of one, I think, to meaningfully respond and to hold together like a sense of integrity, hold together a sense of balance in the face of all that. And there's also the kind of almost like a fragmentation too. I don't want to just dwell on the negative, like as a counterpoint, but it's just to maybe add shading, to our exploration here, it seemed that, and this is going from memory, that in pre-internet, pre-global village, when there was much more asymmetry in the the means of distribution of information and who had access to say things and who could be heard, like part of like that there's almost a protective shell there, because reality is a lot more curated, there were kind of like established channels for making change, like that you could go through, whether those are big organizations or through politics or business and other means, like what I think is happening now is like a lot of that is just becoming a lot more complicated, there's so many options and there's so much happening that it sort of like requires us like to almost go meta and like take the whole thing in, and that is itself like a huge download, and then to still be able to like zero in on the particular, like what is it that you can do, that I can do, that like how are we showing up as a like creative and healthy response to the ugliness that we're seeing, and that's so particular to even this moment, like to a moment to moment, our moment to moment existence. I'm not sure where I'm going with this. I'm just kind of appreciating that, like, how there's no real shortcut out of this. Like, we kind of can imagine, the mind wants to jump to, you know, to the state of being beyond this, imbroglio that we find ourselves in. And I think it's good to have a sense of where we're going, a sense that there is something beyond this. It gets better. Even, you know, sometimes we need a faith in that, because we don't see it, we don't see it ourselves immediately. I guess I'm looking forward to our next reading. I'm eager to read this whole thing through again. It's such vivid language, and it also feels a little bit just preparatory too. Like we're getting it's a bit of a caricature of what this is, of what the darkness holds, if what you say is true, then we're going to get a closer look next time. After we read through this canto again, linger with it. I like lingering with the dark. I think that's this is kind of like time before dawn, before the light has its own sweetness to it. So that's all I have to say.
I can feel this for me. Mateo, I certainly was one of those who. It's like, oh my God, I've got to go through this darkness again. and that I really had difficulty. It's very different this time around. Reading through it is an entirely different experience. Like, this is active right now reality for each one of us to deal with. And do not look away. Yeah. So thank you all.
Thank you.
Shall we do our little meditation? Yeah? Okay.
Thank you, everyone. It's so lovely to be back with you. I missed I missed being with you last time.
Welcome back, Mateo. Thanks, everybody, for all your contributions. Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Beautiful. Thank you.